Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
Hi, everyone. We posted a shorter version of this interview on our regular podcast that also aired on the Radio K radio. This is a longer version of the interview that I did with Blue Delaquanti, who is a Minneapolis-based comic book artist. Her webcomic is called Oh Human Star, and it's about a bunch of different things: transgender robots, LGBTQ issues, identity issues, issues about cloning. Minneapolis plays a big part in her comic as well. It's just a great comic. If you want to make the most out of this interview, maybe go and read a little bit of her comic first, and then come back and listen to the interview. And I think you might find that to be the most rewarding experience. Anyway, thanks for listening. And here is the interview that I did with Blue Delaquanti here at the Radio K studios. Yeah, well, thanks for coming. Thanks for coming up here to talk about the book.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, sure. Can you tell me, because I don't, when we talked the other day, I don't think we talked much about like where you went to school and how you got into making comics.
Yeah, well, comics and cartoons, I guess, in general, was something that I was always interested in as a kid. I always figured I would go into animation, and then when I found out how much of a group effort animation kind of has to be by necessity, at that time, online comics was starting to become more and more popular, more and more accessible, and that's very much a one-man band kind of thing. So I eventually funneled all of my interest in comics I picked up as a kid, a preteen, a teen, and combined it with my interest in science fiction novels, you know, authors like Le Guin and Octavia Butler and stuff. And I ended up just started drawing my own comics in college. I somehow convinced my thesis advisor to have my thesis be a graphic novella, like a 75-page graphic novella. And then once I graduated, I started, you know, working on online comics and all the free time I had to spare.
What is part of this the graphic novella that you were working on?
No. The graphic novella was a independent story that was about young girls and robots, as a matter of fact. It was about a girl being raised in a scientific facility. She'd had an artificial intelligence implanted in a human body. So they were basically trying to raise her as a human girl and see what would happen, like as an artificial intelligence experiment. I thought it was super deep and interesting.
That sounds awesome. Is that published anywhere?
Yeah, if you go onto my professional work site, it's there under, you know, a tab somewhere. You can read it in its entirety.
Oh, okay.
The art is something to look at now. I didn't have a big grasp on digital art just yet, so.
Oh, right on.
It's important. I'm glad it's up there somewhere.
Yeah. And you said you combined some of the stuff that you were reading when you were in your teens, right?
Yeah. Like,
what were you reading back then?
Well, some of the most influential authors I read were, as I said, Ursula K. Le Guin, who has done fantasy like the Earthsea series. The Left Hand of Darkness is a science fiction book she wrote that's really influential to me. Octavia Butler, who people might know for Parable of the Sower, Kindred, a few things like that. More recently, Ian M. Banks, Ann Leckie, lots of like science fiction that plays with what technology does to societies as a whole and how it influences them. That kind of subject is really interesting to me.
Yeah, and what about the comics?
Let me see. I kind of had a very broad, palette to choose from. I remember distinctly being really interested in X-Men, as a kid. Hellboy, later on by Mike Mignola, was really influential. Lots of independent cartoonists. It was kind of impossible to be a kid in 2001 and who was at all comics influenced and not like Jonan Vasquez. He did a comic called Johnny the Homicidal Maniac, which later influenced a cartoon called Invader Zim. I loved that one a lot. That was my teen thing. Later on, the Hernandez brothers and a few more like literary graphic novels influenced me a lot. Fun Home by Alison Bechdel.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Bechdel's awesome. So is Hellboy.
Like, yeah.
I've read a lot of Hellboy.
His sense of composition really taught me a lot about, you know, how to frame shots and tell, you know, what part of the image is really important to frame and treat them all like miniature compositions. And that was really, really important for me as an artist, like a student of art.
Yeah, I was really impressed with how O Human Star uses the still panels. Like, there's you have, can you say a little bit about that, how you use the panels to convey, sort of, even without words, there are these intense moments in there.
Yeah, I absolutely love the chance to create panels that are free of dialogue, that really just illustrate a moment, but that moment is sort of a breathing point or something that communicates something really heavily, even when no dialogue's involved. And I think that's something that Mike Mignola of Hellboy did really well. Lots of Japanese creators that were really influential to me, like Naoki Urasawa, Osamu Tezuka, lots of contemporary manga artists will have that luxury of a few extra pages they can put in these breathing moments that I feel like really improves the pacing and the sense of scale of a book. So I love using them in my own work too.
Yeah, I think you do it really well.
Thank you.
It's pretty great. I think there's one moment, I can't remember if it's in the printed thing or if it's still in the online portion, but when he overhears Al kind of talking, and they refer to, I'm sorry, I forgot that character's name, but they refer to him as like his mouthpiece, or like his, your little cute little spokesperson.
Oh yeah,
and he's just
Butler
standing
robot.
There. Oh no, the other main character.
Oh, at the party. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And he's just standing there with his hand on the wall, and like it that was really cool.
Yeah.
I thought like you really got the awkwardness of that moment.
Yeah, that's a great example, because you get to see like three points of view of how they're absorbing this information at the same time, and being able to like focus on all their faces, like, oh, this one's sort of like waiting to see how this person reacts, and this person has no idea how to react, and they're just like, what do I do? Like, being able to really take the time to absorb, you know, the vibes these characters are giving off in either their body language or their facial expression is so much fun. I love playing with character expressions.
Is that, do you feel confidence when you do that? Because I'm not a pen and pencil artist or whatever, but I can imagine being like, are people going to get what I'm doing here? Or is it just going to feel like here's a still moment that nothing's happening?
I feel like I have enough competence in it at this point that, you know, I sort of understand why I'm making the artistic decisions I'm making. For example, it's not just a matter of the body language and the facial expressions, but I'll also think of sort of how the shot is framed, like a filmmaker would, sort of, you know, at what distance away, whether it's, you know, kind of further away, so you're getting more of the shot and it's a little more leisurely, a little less stressed, or if it's a close-up where, you know, the paying attention to this person's face and what they'll do next is very, very important. Like, whether it's sort of an oppressive high angle, so the person looks small and under pressure, or kind of like a more lower level where it's a little more relaxed. Like, sort of things like that, when you've studied art forms like comics or film or even paintings enough, you sort of become more aware of what these very subtle decisions the artists make, what those do, and you can learn to emulate them in your own work and have it be effective. So I feel like I've picked up enough of that I feel competent at it, even though there's definitely some times where I'll be like, I hope this is getting across what I meant to.
Right.
Yeah. It is, you know, a big leap of faith for you and your readers to see if they're doing what it's doing, what you think it's doing.
I mean, I don't know. In my opinion, it definitely accomplishes it. I want to talk about the subject matter too, because this book is like this awesome combination of, and feel free to give your own synopsis about this, but you know, it's this awesome combination of like LGBT issues and sci-fi. Mm-hmm. And I think on your website, you refer to it as like queer sci-fi, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Can you just say how, like, what prompted those decisions and how you feel about all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I've said before, the elevator pitch, like, the basic elements of the story came together very quickly for me, and it was just a matter of backtracking to sort of figure out how it all came together. So the science fiction themes of the story, like artificial intelligence and sort of what composes an individual human and what makes a person as opposed to a different person, you know, those I feel like marry very well with social themes and topics that I find very interesting that involve, you know, different people on the LGBT spectrum, whether it's, you know, being gay or a non-binary gender or transgender. I feel like, you know, those go together hand in hand very much in, you know, the existing literary canon, but it wasn't that much of a stretch to put them together for my own work. I just find both, you know, wheelhouses very interesting sources of discussion.
Yeah, using AI for that and Sulla's character, where, you know, here's this newly formed person who is like, no, actually, I'm female, so let's go with that.
Mm-hmm. Like, I have like lots of, you know, technology and resources at my disposal that, you know, I can just do this without it being, you know, without the obstacles in way that a lot of, you know, individuals in real life might have to deal with as much.
I don't know. It's just, it's really cool how you presented it in that fashion. And then you can still address things that, for those of us who aren't trans, it probably makes things, it's like a way to understand something that's completely foreign to us.
Yeah. And that was something that I really wanted to take responsibility for demonstrating as well as I could. I myself am not trans, and I've just done a lot of research and, you know, tried to understand the subject through, you know, contemporaries and friends of mine who are, you know, trans or dealing with, you know, the infrastructure and resources they have to deal with, you know, in their everyday lives. And it's one of those things where I'm trying to be conscious about not overstepping my bounds or not making a lot of, you know, leaps on behalf of people that a community that I'm not a part of. But the reception I've heard from readers, and especially readers of mine who come up to me at shows and be like, oh my gosh, as a trans person, you really nailed it. And some people are like shocked that I'm not trans, which is kind of a massive, you know, feeling of approval when I hear that. So, I mean, I feel like I am doing something right, but I, you know, I definitely feel very cautious in that I'm not trying to overspeak all these other amazing trans cartoonists whose work I love that are also talking about things that are much more personal to them in their own ways.
Yeah, I think all of that is really cool. Like the moment in the, I guess they're in the lunch counter where the robot behind the counter can tell that she's a robot too, and she's having to like, she's kind of sweating and ordering something specific so that she passes. That like moments like that are really cool, I think.
Yeah, it's something that I've tried to, you know, emulate without hitting it too much over the head or kind of making it too much about, you know, my work as much. So, but yeah, I appreciate that that comes off well enough to readers like you.
Yeah, yeah. Do you want to talk about maybe how? I feel like we could talk about a lot of different things, but being an independent comic book artist and like making your work succeed. Do you want to say a little bit about that and maybe a little bit about being a web comic artist too?
Definitely. We're in a really, really interesting, exciting time for independent cartoonists of all stripes. The world of online comics, as I think we talked about at that meeting, is in a really, really exciting, you know, creatively fertile time because of all these options for distributing our work, making printed volumes of it. For my own work personally, I basically just started uploading pages. I made myself a site, uploaded pages, began networking and promoting myself on social network sites, Twitter mostly these days. And my work was, I guess, popular enough that I started snowballing readership. And eventually I was able to fund various, like, increasingly large print runs. The first one was, like, a couple, you know, dozen that I would sell at conventions. And then when I would go back in future years, the people who bought my work would remember me. And then, you know, it continued to snowball. And 2 years ago, I ran my first Kickstarter campaign, which, for people who aren't aware, is a crowdfunding website where you can create a project that is either nearly complete or almost like a pre-order system, and people pledge funds of various levels to get that thing. And, you know, over time, you are obliged to fulfill that order, basically. So I was able to fund my first professional print run with an ISBN number and everything through Kickstarter. And I'm actually going to do another one in 2 months. So, yeah, it has never been, a colleague of mine has a saying, which is comics has never been easy, but it's never been easier. There are many platforms in which people who don't, you know, say work at a big company like Marvel or DC, or publish work that would be, you know, more marginalized or not necessarily fit a lot of the ideas of what would be popular bestsellers, they still have lots of venues for selling their work and making a living and getting a readership and be popular. It's really fun. Like, it's a really vibrant community of artists and readers.
It's nice that there's that setup for, like you're saying, with Kickstarter, and you can promote yourself on Twitter now. Mm-hmm. So you funded the print run yourself? Through Kickstarter?
Through Kickstarter,
wow,
yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, it was really great. Prior to that, I had achieved a small grant for a small print run from a network of queer cartoonists and comics professionals that basically give an independent cartoonist, like, a small amount to publish a few dozen or like 100 volumes of something. This was on a whole other level, though. Like, it's professionally printed, and it's got, you know, everything it would need to retail in a bookstore. So, you know, yeah, if it weren't for the platform of Kickstarter and the expertise of people in the community who have created that kind of book before, like, I could not imagine attempting something like this if my career had started even 10 years earlier. It just would not have existed in that way.
Right, yeah, the infrastructure is not there, and Twitter wasn't at the spot that it is now, and all of that. Yeah, for sure. And as far as something you said the other day about web comics, if you don't mind talking about that again,
yeah.
Where I think people were saying at that comic book club that we were at how they liked having the print volume because they can sort of consume it and they don't have to wait.
Mm-hmm.
And then, do you remember what you said about web comics? How every day, it's like the readership experiences it as you're creating it.
Yeah, yeah. There's definitely benefits and drawbacks to the online format, in that when you add in another page in the canon and you update it a little bit more, lots of people get the chance to get feedback right away. You know, whether it's, you know, in a really an emotional page and it hits people super hard, and like, I'm in the middle of a really emotional segment on my website and half the comments are like, how could you do this to me? And, you know, on a more practical way, a lot of times that's where I catch spelling errors. Like, hey, you misspelled determined on Wednesday's update, and it's like, whoops. But yeah, no, that can be both extremely rewarding, like instantly gratifying, and it can, you know, give you a little pause and a little annoyance, like, you know, they're reacting to something, they're asking these questions, but they don't really have the information or the context for this scene, which in its book form would be, you know, answered in a few future pages. So it has drawbacks, but, you know, in a way it's nice to have that, like, instant reaction and sense of community of everybody feeling this way about, you know, what's just happened in this narrative they all like.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the way you said, you phrased it pretty funny the other night. It was like, people were saying, oh, I really like the print version because I can just read it all at once.
Mm-hmm.
You said, yeah, that's great. I'm paraphrasing, but
yeah.
You said, yeah, that's great. It takes you an hour and a half to read, and it took me 3 years to
yeah.
read. And people are like, where's the next one?
Yeah, that definitely is common. And someone had told me that the best way to deal with those feelings is not to think of it as, you know, 3 years of your life being read in an hour, but to multiply that hour by all of your readers, you know, say if you have, like, you know, 1,000 readers or 2,000 readers. You multiply that hour by 2,000, and suddenly the scales feel like they've become more balanced, and that, you know, your work really has paid off over the number of man hours it's taken to appreciate and like reread or consider, you know, the ideas you talk about. So that helps with the despair.
Right. That's great. And I really like how you incorporated Minneapolis into mm-hmm. this. Like, there's scenes that take place in the near future, 2025 or 2021?
2021, yeah.
Yeah, that show the library, and they show, mm-hmm. you know, how does Minneapolis itself tie into your work, and what's it like, just the comics culture here in the cities?
The comics culture has changed a lot in the sort of 10 years I've been familiar with the goings-on here. You know, as you know, MCAD is one of the few colleges in the country that has a specific sequential art program for people wanting to learn comics and getting in the industry. And, you know, it feels like up till a few years ago, most of the students would go there and then kind of leave, either pursue careers, you know, in the industry, like in California or New York, Portland, or elsewhere. But it seems like lately more of them are sticking around and creating loose networks of friends and colleagues who will be able to like see each other in the street, or like, you know, go to meetups. And I feel like there's more of a physical community that sticks around as opposed to when I was first here. As for the character of Minneapolis itself, I'm really fond of it. I didn't grow up here. I only first started living here in high school, but it was sort of the physical character of the buildings and the architecture styles, you know, what people in Minneapolis prioritize, you know, whether it comes to art or, you know, collective outdoor things. And I don't know, for various reasons, Minneapolis very much sort of has a visible character that's very easy to depict when you draw pictures of it or set things in it. So I find myself making stories set there. I have a graphic novel that I started working on that will be probably set here too. And aside from the fact that getting reference images is very, very easy if you live in the town some place is set in, having it set in a place that has a lot of visual character, like New York, but in San Francisco, you know, places where you know that there are landmarks that even if not everyone knows them, you kind of get the idea of what kind of place this city is, you know, is helpful. And Minneapolis is kind of an unknown, lesser known city in that respect.
Right. Yeah. And I feel like there's things to reference, like you did in O Human Star, mm-hmm. where they're talking about going on the skyways.
Yeah, the skyways are a great example, because that's something not a lot of other cities have, but it really is kind of a semi-futuristic thing that people take for granted all the time here. Like, it's such an odd landmark when you think about it.
It's totally bizarre. I moved up here from Florida.
Oh, God,
and,
yeah.
And, yeah, we don't have those. Mm-hmm. And one of my friends lives in St. Paul, right off of the Skyway. Mm-hmm. So to get to her building, mm-hmm. I walk through this other building, and all these shops are closed. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, sort of like storeroom carpet. It mm-hmm. feels like walking through the Enterprise. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, everything's like weirdly lit from the bottom, you know?
And when you compare that to like all of these Art Deco era skyscrapers where everything's stone and gold, and you know, the rubbly flour mills on the river where there's like literally a city park that's just like chunks of stone sticking out of the earth, like that is such a great juxtaposition for this story in particular, what's going between the past and the near future. So just this, like, charming character also translates really well to a near-future setting, I find.
Yeah, yeah. It works great in the story. And I feel like just as a reader of comics like that it's very rewarding for a reader who is reading it from Minneapolis to see.
Yeah.
Like, it just gives you this little, like, push, you know, mm-hmm. when you see it in the comic. Oh, I know. Yeah, I know that building, or mm-hmm. I know that library.
Yeah, yeah. There's a few comics that are kind of love letters to specific places they're set in. Like when I first started going to Toronto for conventions, and I would pass by these buildings, and I realized I knew them from the Scott Pilgrim comics. Like I would pass by Honest Ed's, which is this like extremely profoundly ugly like bargain store with a giant Western sign, and it's the site of a very climactic battle in this comic I grew up as a teen, and I'm standing in front of it, and it makes it much more, you know, like I'm immersed in the city because I've known it from this book. So yeah, if anybody gets that sensation from Minneapolis from my stuff, that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's great. Let's see. Is there anything else you wanted to cover?
I guess I can talk about like influences, you know, that this particular, you know, book has, like stories and things that are connected to it. In the book club, I remember talking about Naoki Urasawa's Pluto, which is a really, really rich world building exercise. It's set in a near future version of Europe, primarily Germany, and it is a world of human and robot societies existing side by side. And there's this sense of tension that's depicted really well in a really subtle way. So when the main narrative of a robot serial killer, basically, who's picking off these very visible, you know, influential robot figures, starts building up, you can tell in how the world has been designed. And I loved that story a lot, and it was really influential when I designed O Human Star. Let me think of what else. Yeah, there's lots of particular artists and the way they come up with worlds and setting design that influenced me a lot. The Hernandez brothers do that with Southern California, and Mike Mignola does that with Hellboy and these really like gothic slash pulp 40s narrative settings.
Yeah, yeah.
And, yeah, they're great masters to learn from.
What's interesting, I think, about, you know, you referenced Pluto, mm-hmm. Which after you talked about it, I put it on hold at the library. I haven't nice. Had a chance to read it yet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny because the subject matter is so different from O Human Star. Like, if you would have told me where the inspiration came before I read the book,
mm-hmm.
I would have came into it with completely different expectations because,
yeah,
you know, this robot serial killer, it's not nearly that
no,
bleak.
Yeah, I feel like in terms of like the narrative that this author in particular is interested in, he loves stories about murder mysteries and sort of like psychological turmoil. That's definitely something he returns to again and again. While I feel like as I've started developing more stories that I enjoy telling, they're much softer. Like, I feel like I'm much more interested in the relationships outside. And we talked about this at the meeting, the fact that the relationships take the front seat to the background, like, mystery that drives the plot forward. You know, while that's sort of the engine, the growing relationships and how they develop and get complicated over time are what steer the wheel, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I find that the narratives that I enjoy crafting the most are the narratives between different people. And I find that I've been doing that more and more in other stories that I get involved in. So in that respect, there's a lot of female cartoonists who are really, really skilled at that, and I get a lot of inspiration from as well. I'm trying to think of examples. Carla Speed McNeil does a lot of stories like that. She does a series called Finder that is set in this extremely rich and complicated world, but she'll basically, like, each story will be a little snippet of the single person in this futuristic alternative Earth. Like, one's just like a story about a girl who loves to read books, and she finds a, you know, a bookstore that she explores over time. Meanwhile, if you zoomed back the lens even a little bit, it would be this, like, extremely kind of dystopian city that's, like, stacked on top of each other, and, like, people with, like, genetic enhancements and, you know, virtual reality movie theaters, and she'll hint at that just a little bit, but it's mostly just about this little girl growing up and going to middle school and reading a lot of books. Or there's, like, you know, there's all kinds of things like that, and that's sort of getting little tastes of a larger, more interesting world while all these more real, immediate human conflicts happen have also attracted me a lot in the last few years.
Yeah, I really like how I think some sci-fi, it almost flips that formula that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the you know, whatever it is, robots or like you were saying, these the technology and things take the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a little bit of background with some relationship things.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like Oh Human Star does, like you're saying, does the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Like it felt so much more real when the action-y part about the big robot sort mm-hmm. of like collapsing, like mm-hmm. it felt way more real than if that was the driving force of the narrative, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear it, because that was the orchestration of that scene was really a challenge for me, and I was trying to figure out how to approach it and when. Like, I think when I designed that chapter, I might have shuffled the events in it like a bajillion times, trying to figure out how to steadily ramp up the tension until that scene. And it's a balancing act. It's difficult. So the fact that it sounds like I did it semi-successfully is encouraging to hear.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it felt pretty real to me. Mm-hmm. And it didn't feel like the tension behind Al, like he's obviously the celebrity that's sort of walking around, but it mm-hmm. doesn't feel too heavy-handed either.
Yeah, yeah, because, like, you know, most people, like, don't want to be that person who bothers a clearly famous person. Like, it's kind of, you might just see, like, a furtive look or, you know, maybe just, like, a kind gesture. But, you know, if you compound that over time with someone who doesn't even really understand why they're there or what's happening to them, like, that leads to a lot of interesting scenarios in my mind.
Yeah, 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 and I can definitely see the influence of the Hernandez brothers, like you were saying.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, their stuff is very real.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't read a ton of it, but enough to know that it is like that.
They play off each other really well too. They go for different things, Jaime and Gilbert. So it's interesting reading stories of theirs back to back.
And they're simple. Sort of, I don't know, I don't have the words for it, but they're simple, like, drawing style.
Really
it,
clean and crisp, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I can see how that, was that an influence also?
Yeah, probably early on. I think the medium that I use helps, too. It's much easier to be clean and crisp with digital tools, as opposed to when I work with physical media, it's usually like a nib pen. It's a little more scraggly, there's a little more texture to it. So that changes my art. Like, for this, digital works perfectly because you get nice smooth lines and cool, you know, digital shading and stuff like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm sure you had to walk, like, this fine line between showing how Sulla and Al, mm-hmm. the similarities between the two of them,
mm-hmm.
and just their noses,
yeah.
and the similarities between their noses.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was so great.
Thank you. That was a really, yeah. I love drawing profiles and kind of having that be part of character design. Like, there were lots of little things I decided to come up with early on to distinguish all of the characters. And a lot of it is, like, you know, stuff that no one will notice. Like, I try and have Al's default face have his mouth closed and Brendan have his mouth open. And, you know, especially when it comes to, like, trying to define the similarities between this, like, older middle-aged character and this younger teen, like, trying to unify them through some, like, physical, you know, design elements, but also distinguishing them through their body language or the way they will phrase sentences is a lot of fun. But yeah, beaky noses are a lot of fun to draw.
and it just ties them together so nicely,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
And that narrative too of how, you know, Brandon and Al, Brandon's the young guy in this mm-hmm. in this relationship with this older man, and mm-hmm. then, you know, 20 years later, it's now flipped on its head.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was such a cool device for this.
Yeah, that was something that, as I actually started working with it and, like, thinking about how they would change and how their dynamic would change, that changed a lot. And I had to think a lot about what would happen to this person who kind of goes into this, what the internet calls a May-December relationship. like, really, you know, assertive and, like, fun and maybe, like, not taking it super seriously at first, but just, like, you know, really confident. And then through all these events, like, kind of lose confidence yourself or, like, have this sort of shadow of doubt kind of appear in your life and becoming more cautious, realizing it's not all about you, and just kind of, like, experience, like, what that does to the same character is really fun to contemplate and to kind of depict that in a story. Like, Brendan's kind of got an interesting complication in his story as a result of that.
Oh, yeah, that's yet to come up, right?
Yeah. There's, you're going to see more of that for sure a little later on in the story, chapter 6.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Great, yeah. I think it's online. I think it's in the online portion, but when we get to see Al go from bearded Al to mustache Al.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, I just felt like that moment was so perfect.
Yeah, I was really looking forward to that moment, because that's the when the you know needle drops, and that's when everyone's like, oh, this is happening now, because it's like a return to literally the first few pages of the book. You know, you finally have the context for it. So, that instantaneous reader reaction was very interesting that day.
And just the, you know, it felt so true to relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Just the instant reaction of Brendan's when mm-hmm. he shaves.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like such a dumb, it's such a dumb reason for an argument, but everyone's had that. Like, everyone's had that serious argument that's spawned from something extremely dumb and inconsequential.
Right. Yeah. It was so good. It was so good. Let's see. And did we cover everything? Or I'm sure we didn't cover everything.
we got good groundwork for sort of like the basis of how my career exists.
Okay. Great. Yeah. This was awesome. I would love to talk to you about comics whenever you want to. Basically.
Yeah. Definitely.
So. Cool. Well, yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
That was the interview I did with Blue Delaquanti. Again, the webcomic that she writes is called Oh Human Star. If you want to read the comic for yourself, which you absolutely should, you can head over to the letter ohumanstar.com. And if you want to check out more podcasts from us, you can find those here at Real College Podcast website, radiok.org/Real College Podcast, all one word. For the Real College Podcast, I am Peter Zimmerman.